Here's from four major corporations with us today. And Michael Gray, who, as you know, of course, president of the association and music librarian at Voice of America, will make further introductions for this morning's panel. I hope that you'll all have questions to ask in the book.
I hope it's heads up.
Let's heads up. Take. Oh, yeah. Oh, you plan this up?
It's a disclaimer.
Oh, disclaimer?
Yeah. How have you been?
Very good. How have you been?
Good.
How's Chick?
Oh, just driving and blooming and blossoming, you know.
Good. Keith, who does the transfers for Pathé Marconi or the refrain? You do? Upstairs? You do? Oh, they're wonderful. They're very good. Oh, they're marvelous. Some of the Tristan came out tremendously.
I didn't do that.
You didn't do that one, huh?
What? Kristen Parker did.
That's good. The Villandusca things came out well.
Not bad. Not bad. Have you heard the Croate Heidi Quartet?
No. Are they great?
Fantastic.
Yeah?
They're the best things I've ever done. The music is wonderful.
Yeah, I'll have to get them. They have them down
there.
I'll have to get them. I have the Schubert on record. That's great.
Record enthusiasts, in fact, even might use the word record nut, and they're more fortunate than most of us because they actually work in the business of making those things that take up so much of our time, money, and complaints from our wives. But we were fortunate this time to have representatives of what I consider to be the most of the major companies operating in the United States and, in fact, around the world to talk about what's being done to make their archives available to people who buy records, in this case compact discs, and also to talk further on subjects that might come up from the floor. Our panelists begin with Alison Ames, who has been with Deutsche Grammophon since 1973. Before that, she was in publicity at the New York Public Library, and since 1980, she's been head of U.S. operations for the Yellow Label. To her left is Peter Mumbies, a 30-year veteran of the record business. He began in retailing and for 17 and a half years with Columbia Records, primarily in marketing. Afterwards, he traveled down 6th Avenue a few blocks to RCA Redsteel, where he was responsible, among other things, for the Heifetz, Rachmaninoff, and Caruso sets. Then between 1975 and 79, after he left RCA Redsteel as its chief, he was active with Pinkert Records and the Quintessence label. And since 1979, he has been at CBS Records once again, this time director of market planning. Right. To his left is Jerry Plano from RCA Records. He got his start in the record business through the assistance or sufferance, I suppose, of a great uncle who owned a furniture and music store. And Jerry thereby learned the Victor catalog backwards and forwards, a knowledge that since has proved him, served him well since he joined RCA Records in 1963 after a career as an independent producer for another Time Life Records. He currently is head of A&R for RCA Special Products, working with such companies as Reader's Digest, Time Life Books, Book of the Month Club, and the Metropolitan Opera. And finally is Keith Hardwick. Keith gave me a note about his career saying he was born in England at an unspecified time, sometime in the 20th century. His first contact with music came at the age of 10 from Gili Santa Lucia, and he since became interested in other performers such as Schnabel, Toscanini, Battistini, and Melba. Immediately after the war, he joined EMI as an apprentice balance engineer, but then took a 29-year holiday as a member of the Royal Navy. And in 1979, I believe he succeeded, 77, succeeded Anthony Griffith as head of EMI's restoration work in the 13 at Abbey Road Studios. Since everybody's lined themselves up at the table, we're going to start with Alison to talk briefly about what she does, what her company is doing, I hope not just in the United States, but around the world, in reviving and resuscitating recordings in the DG catalog for release on compact discs. So without further ado, I'll talk. Allison is also going to talk not just about Gramophone, but also about sister labels at Philips and London Decca. So, Allison.
Thank you, Michael. I really can't talk too much about London and Philips since I don't know too much about what they're refurbishing toward me. Okay. What their refurbishing or re-release plans and policies are. I can say very briefly that, as you all undoubtedly know, Philips has reissued on CD a substantial number of Mengelberg performances. That was their first. It's not working at all. Okay. Is that better? No, I can tell. The Philips Mengelberg recordings on CD are the first in what is, it's hoped, will be a fairly extensive series of reissues of pre-war mono old recordings. In any event, by now, anything even from the 40s is old, I'm sorry to say. I'm part of that decade. But the London program, or the London Decca program of restoration, has been getting a lot of publicity. They call this ADRM, which I guess stands for Analog Digital Remastering. It seems to be unnecessary. It seems to me to be unnecessary to rave about how wonderful the Decca engineering was and how they're going back and refurbishing that so beautifully. I mean, everyone who collects records knows how good the Decca engineering is. Excuse me, Mr. Hardwick. Deutsche Grammophon, on the other hand, of the three labels, suffered the most damage to the archives during the war, and I'm sure that most of you know about this from other Deutsche Grammophon people who have spoken at other conferences or for us. And it is the I guess very pleasant, if sometimes very frustrating, duty of Alfred Kane, an American working in Hamburg at the Deutsche Grammophon headquarters, to try to trace pristine copies of shellacs that whose matrixes or other original material have vanished from our archives. I know some years ago he was very excited by the prospects of the big find in Prague, which, or elsewhere in Czechoslovakia. There was a Deutsche Grammophon factory there, which seemed to have been spared what happened to the Hanover factory, and I guess it didn't really turn up a whole lot. In any event, Deutsche Grammophon's so far only foray into the refurbishing of mono recordings is the series of Furtwängler reissues, which came out here in January of this year. I made a lot of my colleagues around the world very angry by demanding that I be able to have them in January, which meant that they had to get them out early for me to get them across the ocean. And we made it in time for the actual centennial. As I said to David Hamilton on the way in here, we know, unfortunately, from sad experience of all the reissues of Furtwängler material over the years, reissues, because Deutsche Grammophon actually has very little material in this of this great conductor's output, that there are about 1,500 people in the States who always buy the Furtwängler reissues. I don't know whether it's the 1,500 original Furtwängler fans or that they have created, you know, set out spores and infected 1,500 other people, but
it's the Furtwängler cylinder collection.
Right. In any event, I'm happy to say that we've sold a lot more than 1,500 each of the CDs, which means either the offspring of the original Furtwängler fans have bought CD players, or the original Furtwängler fans have bought CD players, or both. More than that, I really can't say at the moment. I think what will happen is that the huge resurgence in interest in classical music, or let's say standard classical music, classic classical music, in among the record-buying public, created very much as a result of the compact disc's success, will allow us to go farther and deeper into the archives to pull out materials that we perhaps have not reissued at all on LP, or we've not reissued in the last 20 or 30 years. I know during the 13 years I've been with the label, there was only one attempt in this country to reissue Fort Wengler's, the famous 1500. We had the Fort Wengler's Second Symphony, which I'm sure you remember, and which I've been yelling for on CD. I know that we could do well with that. Apart from that, I don't know of any immediate future plans. I hope I'll be able to give you some definite information next year.
All right, and now, Allison, if you want to get a lot of Polydors, there's a gentleman sitting right dead center there with a beard and a mustache who's got quite a big collection. Mr. Smolian has an enormous collection of Polydors from the acoustic and electrical era. And also the library right here has a wonderful collection. And I think that you ought to get as much of that on tape as you can, because I've seen the condition of the records here. They're pristine. Mm. So they'd make very good transfers, because a lot of that material, I mean, the shells are gone.
Yeah,
you know, the material, and that's the problem with a lot of the Telefunken things, the Mengelberg things, because I've been after some of those, and they're impossible to get. They were all destroyed, well, most of them during the war. So that's a big problem. All right, now let me talk about CBS. I was talking out of my hat here because I'm a collector too. I lead a double life. You see, after 5 o'clock, I'm a collector, and between 9 and 5, I work for CBS. And we have actually an archive at CBS that is quite extensive. It contains 70,000 LP discs and commercial tapes. This is a private archive for the company. 200,000 tapes going all the way back to the monaural era, 1948. And 4,000 16-inch safeties, which were recorded simultaneously with the 78 RPM records during our sessions in the 40s. Now, a lot of the early LPs came from these 16-inch safeties, and poor Howard Scott stayed up till half past the next morning, even making the joins, because even with the 16-inch safeties, we had to make joins there in getting the first and the initial LPs out. We have catalogs of cylinder recordings going back to 1894. We have catalogs of 78s going back to 1904 and extending, of course, to the end of the 78 RPM era in the late 40s. We have catalogs of long-playing discs and 45 RPM recordings from 48 to the present. We have catalogs of phonographs covering early graphophones and graphonolas, cylinder and disc machines, and Columbia audio products from 1890 to 1970. Our card files on 78s are incredibly incomplete. They are filed by matrix number, catalog number, and artist, but now that we have the Rigler Deutsch, as far as the issued records are concerned, we're in pretty good shape. The repertoire is divided pop, jazz, classical, and ethnic. And this includes, from the early 78 RPM acoustic era, vocal recordings by great opera singers Poncel, Stracciari, Boninsegna, Nordica, Fremstad, and many others. Instrumental recordings by Casals, Joseph Hoffman, Leopold Godowsky, Percy Grainger, and also many others. From the electrical era, the first electrical recordings of combined choruses of over 500 voices in the New York Metropolitan Opera House. CBS did, Columbia Masterworks did make the first electrical recording because of our relationship with the Westrex company at that time. Then, of course, from the early part of the century, we had a deal with Phonotypia, in which we got a lot of Maria Barrientos and a lot of other exciting recordings. We also had an exchange with English Parlophone, and we were connected with Mr. Hardwick's company, EMI, for many years. And for a while there, EMI owned American Columbia. So we issued recordings from the English Parlophone labels, Odeon, and on the Columbia Vivatonal labels. Some important artists were Lehman, Melchior, Bettendorf, Rethberg, Tauber, Domgraf, Fassbinder, Feuermann, and von Schillings. English Columbia, of course, you know about, because that's the great English Columbia catalog from the 30s, including Gieskind, Godowsky, Hardy, Myra Hess, Friedman, Feuermann, Casadesu, Lapati, Mengelberg, Harold Samuels, and many, many more. The domestic holdings, which we still have the rights to, include from the very early electrical era, Anna Case, Casado, Jose Achanes, Tchaikovsky and Hubert, a marvelous recording of the Rachmaninoff Sonata, was sure to come out eventually. Some very early Copelands, Harry Kumson, Enesco. He's just shaking his head there because he never knew that I knew this, you know, this Smolian. And he thinks he knows everything. Percy Grainger, Myra Hess, Ethel Laginska, Felix Salmon, who, by the way, taught here at the Institute of Musical Art, which became Juilliard. Paul Whiteman Jazz Orchestra, and by the way, there's a wonderful recording of the Concerto in F with Roy Bargy, and it's the way it really should sound because it's done. There's a tremendous prominent saxophone part in there, and the whole thing, nobody plays it that way today. The piece is completely distorted, but this is really a historical document, which was probably recorded around 1927, and the way to find that is on the Potato Heads. With Paul Whiteman's caricature on it, because those pressings were very good. In the 40s, of course, CBS with Edward Wallerstein and Goddard Lieberson rated RCA Victor. And we got the following: Barbaroli, New York Philharmonic, the Budapest and the Busch String Quartets, which were then playing for EMI, but over here because of the war, Robert Casadesu, Benny Goodman, Horzhovsky, Leinsdorf, Cleveland, Metropolis with Minneapolis first, then with the New York Philharmonic, Ormandy, Philadelphia, Rudzinski first with the Cleveland, then with the New York Philharmonic, Fritz Reiner with the Pittsburgh Symphony, which, by the way, their historic recording, the first recording of the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, was one of the first modern music LPs, LPs and 78s, to become a bestseller. Schoenberg conducting his own Pierrot Lunaire, Rudolf Serkin, Isaac Stern, later Friedrich Stock, Chicago, Joseph Zaghetti, Stokowski first with the All-American Youth Orchestra, then with the New York Philharmonic, and Bruno Walter with the New York Philharmonic. Many of those artists had been either EMI or RCA artists. Well, the long-playing records archives, we have over 70,000 commercial releases from June 1948 to date. We have 10 and 12-inch LPs. We have several copies of the of these LPs in all confirmations. And we have a very important series, Landmarks, there, which Mr. Smolian was helping us for a long time get, because some of these we didn't even have. In other words, when we started the archives after some of these had been released. But we have copies of all the Lieberson-produced Broadway shows. Now, these are landmarks in recorded history, all the way going back from Kiss Me, Kate, with Alfred Drake and Patricia Morrison, and all the way up to the end of his career. We have the Lieberson-produced Legacy series. The first ones were Richard Bale's cantatas on the North and the South, the Union and Confederacy, and sold tremendously well. But there were series in there about the generations of Israel, and to be even-handed, we did one on Ireland. We've done one on the Bad Men of the West, in which we raided the archives of one Schneider, Mr. Schneider, who was a lawyer who had over several hundred thousand 78s, and we were able to get very interesting material from that era, the ballads that were produced all the legends of the Bad Men of the West. Besides the other Lieberson-produced series, there were the literary series with great authors reading from their own works, and, of course, the Modern American Music series, which gave us, believe it or not, Leontine Price's first recording way before she went to RCA, which was the Hermit Songs with Barbara at the piano, among other things, works by Harris, Menon, William Schumann, Della Gioia, and many, many more. Of course, in the 50s, we added many important artists such as Fleischer, Gould, Zell, and the Cleveland. We started to make the recordings with Bruno Walter and the Columbia Symphony at the end of the 50s and the 60s. Two very unique series, of course, which really go into the documentation of how composers wanted their music to sound, are the Stravinsky Conducts Stravinsky series and Copland Conducts Copland. Those are two important series which will go down in the history of recording as unique documents. Among the important firsts that we've had, unusual firsts, Krasner playing the Berg Violin Concerto, what was dedicated to him. As I said, the Barbara Hermit songs with Leontine Price, Berg's Lulu, Berg's Wutzeck in the first recording by Metropolis, the New York Philharmonic, Bernstein conducting his own symphonies, believe it or not, the Ives Symphony No. 4 with Stokowski conducting and Ozawa, and I think Jose Cerebria helping out on that because of the multiple orchestras. And there were a lot of other interesting first recordings, and unique things, such as Bartok playing from his own Microcosmos, and the contrast with Bartok and Joseph Zaghetti, made in 1940. All right, we also have quite an extensive library of merchandising and promotion LPs and tapes, samplers for salesmen and radio stations. We have artist samplers, commercial tape releases. And these are all copies of that were released at 7.5 when we began, reel to reel, and also our cassettes. I won't bore you with the rest of the material here. 8 tracks we have. We have some 8 tracks. All right. Thank you, my dear. What else now? It's quite an... All right, we have 175,000 tapes of old monaurals and stereos at Iron Mountain, which is upstate New York. We have 25,000 more recent stereo tapes at CBS Studios, and we have the 4,000 instantaneous 16-inch safeties at our CBS Studios here in New York. All right, the important thing is that what we're doing with the compact disc is we're going back to the work parts, and that's why all the critics flipped when they heard the Bruno Walter recordings, because when they initially came out, we had the RIAA curve, and with the RIAA curve, we put a bass boost in, and because we put a bass boost in, we had to put a treble boost, so the middles got lost. What we did is we went back to the 4-track work parts, which we had, and most of them were down here somewhere in Iron Mountain, and we discovered that we had a beautiful sound right from the American Legion Hall in Los Angeles, where the recordings were made. And with very, very little work, we were able to really give you the sound that was on those 4-track master tapes. So they were remixed, and they were digitally remastered, and that's what we've done with all our compact discs. And the results are really spectacular because people are really hearing what's on these records for the first time. And this is an important sound restoration. And we hope to, in fact, we are going to do it now. My job there for the next 5 years is very secure because I have to take care of this entire catalog and the restoration of it and the transference of it onto compact disc. It's going to be a major undertaking. Already scheduled are all of the Mahler symphonies with Leonard Bernstein. We have to beat Phillips to the punch, I'm sorry.
DG.
And is it, what?
DG.
Why, I thought they're coming out on Phillips.
No, my dear, they're DG.
Well, they're DG, I'm sorry. Well. Say like
that. Everybody lumps Polygram together.
Okay, I thought it was Phillips. It is DG.
No.
All right, he's coming out of DG.
Owns us.
Oh, only Phillips. All right. So, all right, and the 9 Beethoven symphonies, of course, are scheduled, and there are a lot of more things scheduled with Stern, Serkin, Sell, and the Cleveland. So we have to really concern ourselves with the immediate past. As far as the more distant past, past is concerned, we are looking into very, very interesting reissues. But we're going to, because of our limited capacity now, we expect that to open up within the next year enormously. We may probably be able to get to some of those very interesting issues. But, of course, we have had some marvelous issues from the past, and with the cooperation of EMI, we produced Casals, Musician of the Century. We produced the art of Joseph Zaghetti, going all the way back to the very early recordings that he made at the turn of the century, and including some of his great EMI recordings. On jazz, we've had magnificent reissues in the John Hammond collection concerning Bessie Smith, which, by the way, turned out to be a magnificent seller, and Louis Armstrong, Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington. I mean, that's priceless. In fact, jazz recordings, as interesting as classical recordings, though, and I think classical recordings are great because those are the ones I collect, and I'm also starting to collect jazz. You can ask Morty Savada. I've asked him for all his Fats Wallace. I'm going crazy about Fats. He says. But there are two interesting things about recordings, and then I'm going to pass on here because I want Jerry. Jerry's got a great archive. I'm sorry, I get carried away. But the interesting thing about jazz recordings is that they really document the improvisations. That's the only documentation that we have of improvisations on those jazz recordings. And they document the whole feel of an era, which if it hadn't been for the recordings, would never have been documented. The great thing about classical performances that I collect, especially instrumental and some vocal, and a chamber and orchestral, is that the era of the first part of this century documents, because I've done a lot of thinking about this, the bel canto style of playing orchestrally and instrumental. And it's only documented on those great recordings. It's practically a style which is non-existent today. And with that, I end.
I think I have the most fortunate part of the program in that a representative of the commercial department of RCA had been invited to the symposium and was not available. And then I was asked to participate. And my field is very narrow and rather broad because it represents substantial amount of reissues for RCA Records. But you have to bear in mind that it's not a commercial operation. And therefore, I will not, at this point, until we have the questions and answers, touch upon the commercial part of the RCA catalog. But I will start by telling you that in 1985, the RCA Special Products Department released the equivalent of 500 long-playing records embodying 5,000 bits of recorded repertoire information. So that should give you an insight as to this special market that you as archivists might want to explore to find out what is being released at Columbia Special Products, RCA Special Products, Columbia Special Products, MCA and Warner Brothers, and of course Deutsche Grammophon. Because within these collections there do appear many of the recordings that the public or archivists seem to be looking for. And those of you who are familiar with the Metropolitan Opera Guild series know that many historical recordings were released in the last two or three years, not only embracing recordings from the old Victor catalog, but from the celebrated vaults of Deutsche Grammophon and EMI. We get a lot of inquiries at RCA from archivists. They tend to gravitate to the Special Products Department because the word gets out through one archivist that I met 26 years ago, and it's a whole round robin, and the phones ring and these letters come in. And I always tell the archivists that the RCA archives and files can be open to them, and indeed will be open to them, if they would only write to us or call us and tell us when they would like to come in, because many times, as Mr. Williams knows, there'll be 40 people in the tiny little archive department that we have. One thing that Peter talked about that came to mind reminded me of something. While many times we have to go to the Library of Congress or the Lincoln Center Library to get a transcription of one of our own Victor records, you know, made in 1919 or whatever, it's odd, or it's interesting, that believe it or not, from the time that Mr. Berliner and Mr. Johnson went into business in 1901, we have every recording contract on every artist who ever recorded for us, whether they recorded for royalty or flat for fee. The other thing I wanted to mention now, I'm only speaking for Special Products now, not commercial. And as we get into 1987 and we have more production facilities available, we should be hitting 50% of the catalog. I can really tell you that you're going to see the same replay you saw from the 78 days into the LP days, into the reel-to-reel days, and into the 8-track days, stereo 8, into the cassette days, that you're going to see a lot of the same material being issued again, and it's all going to be there. And we do get inquiries, you know, that my Aunt Gertrude recorded, or Great Aunt Gertrude recorded, two songs for you in 1926, and why haven't you made this available, and we're going to sue your company if you don't make this available, and that kind of thing. But the CDs will be out there. The Special Products group at RCA are going to start releasing CDs in September of this year, which means that the Reader's Digest and the Time Lives will be making their special editions available in the compact disc format. Now, this is just a fantasy on my part. I wouldn't put all my faith in the CDs because we're going to be going by 1990 or 1992 into something called the TD. And the TD is, you do not go to a record store and buy this product. The TD is called Teledisc. You're going to have all these directories, just piles and piles of directories of everything ever recorded from the beginning of the time on, and you will punch into your phone code a TD entry, and then voila, it'll come up on the speaker. And this will be the recording industry way of not issuing product and keeping control of the artist royalties and the publisher's mechanical royalties, because you will pay per punching in or whatever. So bear that in mind, that I was the gentleman who came up with the TD concept.
Okay. You're going to put all the collectors out of business?
Yes, we're going to put all the collectors out of business.
What
no.
What they will do is they will take. They will tape, right?
All the collectors. No, we're going to not make tape anymore. Okay. And I think all of you know that that the RCA catalog or archive is almost as large as the Columbia archive. And that's what I have to say until the question and answer period.
As far as we in England are finding, historical reissues are playing a much greater part now than they've played for a very long time, as far as the black disc is concerned. This is because we find increasing consumer reluctance to pay full prices for black disc records, which are already available on cassettes and becoming available on CD. But there is an increasing market for the lower priced historical reissue, which is why I'm having to run very hard to stay in the same place this year and actually having to turn work away because EMI Music in England is asking for more and more issues on the black disc. As far as CD is concerned, we are very much constrained at the moment by the worldwide lack of capacity, particularly for ourselves, because in our wisdom we decided that the CD was quite unimportant and we didn't want to have anything to do with it. A decision that needs to surprise no one, because we thought the same about the LP.
How about the 78?
Oh, that's okay. And I might remind RCA that they made the 45 mistake. So.
In the TD.
But turning for the moment to CD, we have already got quite a number of what you might call recent historical records available and in the pipeline. A lot of Fürth Wängler, a lot of the Callas operas are coming back on CD. The Beecham Bohème is in the pipeline. It's a little irritating to me, actually, that the very first of my own products has appeared on CD, but not in England. The Beethoven concertos played by Schnabel are available in America on the Arabesque label, which I did for them. But EMI hasn't taken it up. Let's hope they'll learn better in the future. As far as immediate reissue program is concerned, this year we have a very heavy schedule of issues from the past, some of which may evoke some interest, like the Mozart Requiem conducted by Bruno Walter in Paris in 1937 with Schumann, Kipnis, Thorborg and Del Mota. We have a Toscanini album of all his BBC Beethoven recordings, including some hitherto unpublished material. There's the fourth and final volume of the Record of Singing coming out in the end of the year. A 4-LP album of Shalyapin, including a lot of stuff that's never been on European Western LP before. I didn't leave aside the Melodia issue, which is in lousy sound. Then a lot of albums of other singers, Josef Schmitz, Alessandro Valente, Hina Spani, Nino Vellin. And in France, I'm just about to start work on a 8-LP album called Les Introuvables du Chant Verdien. Verdi. Flagstad in Wagner, including some unpublished material. That's also for the end of the year in England. Next month, complete Battistini collection on 7 LPs, including some unpublished material. I say complete, it isn't quite complete, because 4 of his known records are so well known that no one's heard a copy of them. If anyone has a copy of him singing Il Balen, I'd be delighted to know. As for next year, I have in mind two La Scala albums covering the two periods when Toscanini was in control there. Some more Pro-Arte string quartets, some more Busch quartet material, possibly a Mengelberg record after the colossal CD issue by the Yellow Peril. No, it was Phillips.
It's not me.
I beg your pardon. I should have said Phillips. I'm not sure that it's worthwhile us going ahead with Mr. Mengelberg. And as for the extreme future, I'm quite sure that just as most of the best of the 78s has been available sometime, someplace on the LP, in the next 10 years or so, most of the best of 78s will be available on CD. I hope so. My case rests.
Now that everyone's made their presentation, I was wondering if we could start again with Allison and work our way down about how one decides what one puts out and how one decides what one doesn't put out. And particularly regarding the international activities of companies. For instance, there's the American market, but we're certainly aware of the Japanese market, the continental market, France, Germany, United Kingdom. How does one, in an international company, come to a decision regarding what is prepared for reissue and what is not prepared for reissue?
Michael, could I also ask that the panelists perhaps address themselves to some areas besides classical music, too?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, an international company, if I can obviously speak only for Deutsche Grammophon in this respect, our reissue policy at the moment is constrained by what Keith Hardwick mentioned. Even for us, the too small capacity of CD manufacturing, even with our own factory or a factory owned by the same company that owns us, my catalog of about 320 CDs is about 35% out of stock at the moment. That just can't be helped. So there's that problem on the one hand, and our reducing every year our expectations of how many older titles we'll be able to bring out this year. I just got yesterday a list of about 30 CDs which would have been released during the last quarter of this year in Europe, which will be put off until the first third of next year. And who knows, maybe before the end of the year I'll have even more cutbacks. It's most unfortunate, most frustrating. However, there's every indication that the CD capacity and worldwide capacity will increase tremendously by the end of next year. And Philips and DuPont have made quite a go at developing a factory in North Carolina, which should be online by the end of next year. That will alleviate the problem somewhat for us, but in what way isn't yet known, whether they'll be making commercial music CDs or industrial CDs or a CD-ROM or all of the above, and whether only for Polygram or for other companies as well. One aspect, this is an aside, one thing that we're working on at the moment or is being worked on in Europe is a CD-ROM Polygram catalog that would show, we hope, everything that's ever been recorded for the Polygram labels. I know about this at any rate from the DG people. Alfred Kane is busily plugged into a small computer in his office 8 hours a day, and since he contains it all in his head, practically, it's really a remarkable undertaking. But that a CD-ROM, one disc could conceivably hold the entire archives or index to all the recordings ever made anywhere, if it were possible to get them all together in one place. It's vast capacity on one little disc. That, of course, would make any archivist grin. And now, as far as the decision-making process is concerned about reissues, as far as this goes, DG is a very internationally minded company, and I find this very frustrating often. If I travel to Europe and see in record shops the fabulous reissues from EMI RCA and even CBS, which I think is a little less active in that area than the other two companies, I realize once again how, in a way, limited Deutsche Grammophon's A&R policy has been, that we've been very much, well, increasingly in the 13 years I've been with the label, very much geared to recording artists who have an international career, and very little toward developing young talent or saying in Norway, well, you have a terrific young artist there you want to record, here's some money, go record him or her, or in any other country. At EMI, of course, still Electrola has a very active recording policy. I know EMI England has a very active local recording policy, and I know this is true in other companies as well. And sometimes that really frustrates me. On the other hand, it means that we can offer to active recording artists the same sort of service, if you will, worldwide, that they get in their home country, assuming they live in the West somewhere. We haven't broken down Moscow or Peking yet, but we're working on it. So, as I say, the reissue policy is, in a way, governed by the same sort of rules, that we try to keep the extremely, spread the extremely high costs of reissue, and they are increasing all the time, over a number of countries at one time, so that if a reissue of some sort is contemplated, I will be asked, along with my colleagues in major markets around the world, how many of this do you think you can sell? Is it going to be worth our while to get new liner notes, a new cover, remastering, et cetera, et cetera? And I'm afraid that this is an increasingly big problem for all of us, that reissue costs tend to be to go up just as rapidly as recording costs, and the day of the teledisc, which isn't so very different from, does anyone remember a big brouhaha self-promotion by an outfit called the Home Music Store? It was around in 1981, I think. They had a big reception at a fancy restaurant here in New York and announced, you were there, Sedgwick, I think. Do you remember this? it was some outfit that's...
You were there.
Okay, in any event, they announced a thing to try and get all the record companies to cooperate in this, a thing that would allow anyone to punch up a number on his telephone or his modem or whatever and hear, I don't know, Furt Wengler's ninth from whatever year at a specific time at home. Now, what we all know is that human beings are very acquisitive, and they don't give a damn if they can get it over their home computer. They want it on a shelf in their own house, even if they only play it once every 10 years. And I think that's what will keep us, all of us, in business, that people do want to own things, fondle them, look at them, compare them to other people's collections, and have their wives and, I hope, increasingly husbands bitch at them about how much space it takes.
The wives are jealous. The males are fondling the records.
Yes, but have you noticed how many more women are buying records now because of the fact that CDs are so easy to use? They're small. I mean, even a large ham-fisted man needs two hands to handle an LP or a 78. And, you know, I can handle a CD with one hand, and I can't even do an octave on a piano. I think it's helping. Incidentally, I've always heard how few women are involved in the collecting of records, and I can see that here, that the membership, female membership, is fairly small, or at least those who showed up today. At the moment, the three record labels within Polygram Classics, Deutsche Grammophon, London and Philips, are run by women in this country. And I don't know whether this means that running the classical label has become women's work, i.e.
if
drudgery.
If I have a sex change, can I get a job over there?
Why would you want to work for us? That'll be the day.
Well, some people will do for money.
Money, hell,
slack. So I don't know whether it's a movement or not. It either means that the schlepping around to 82 concerts a week and officiating at this kind of thing unprepared is something that only a woman would do, or whether there just aren't any men good enough left within PolyGram to do this job. It's one or the other.
You have a high attrition rate there, PolyGram. Men. Kill men, then. Better be very careful.
Oh, yeah?
That's what you're saying. You said there aren't any good men left.
So, any questions? I don't know. Oh, popular music. Somebody wanted me to mention popular music. I'm very unfamiliar with that area for Polydor, because as a German company, of course, it featured principally German artists, always. And only in recent years has become tremendously international on the classical side and even on the pop side. I mean, as pop music has been utterly taken over internationally by American or English performers, or by others who sing in English, like ABBA, the Swedish group, it's not a problem. But I just can't answer any of that. I do, remember a special issue, and I think I have it on cassette at home, of a two-cassette set issued by DGG in Germany called Damals und Heute in 1977 for the centennial of recorded sound, and they sort of pulled out pop and classical things from the catalog for as far back as they could, I guess back to 1898, and indiscriminately mixed all sorts of things. It was a lot of fun. But I don't know of any plans in the immediate future of this type for CD. I don't know anything about it. I don't even know when it took place.
Well, that's what I'm trying to ascertain. I'm just wondering perhaps as to whether you knew anything about the corporate background of the component units.
That's
Zip.
Really off the subject of this panel.
Okay.
Be that as it may, I don't.
Sort of backed into an issue which is of concern to me, both from the legal standpoint, because of the fact that the American copyright law with respect to phonographs is not in sync with most European copyright laws, and also the interest of certain maven collectors, myself included, in trying to get out, if we want to throw our own money away, shall we say, material that is not of a broad-based interest, but that we perceive as being important. One of the things there are two things that we are looking to. One is the insistence of companies that have special products divisions that we use their engineers and that we meet their minimum pressing requirements, that we can't use our own pressing plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the reluctance that is born from the fact that, which is understandable, that to put it on the house computer, so to speak, as being something that somebody wants to do to press 500 copies or 1,000 copies or whatever, costs more than it's worth in any conceivable royalty return, especially in a situation where the royalty rate becomes ridiculously high because of perceived obligations to an artist or an artist's estate if the artist was a royalty artist. Do you see any way that the record industry, either on an individual company-by-company basis, can, or as a group, can develop some sort of a policy to make it easier for those of us who, say, just for lack of a better example, decide for some strange reason that we want to put out all the Albert Sitar organ records, make it humbler for Polydor in the late 1920s on a black disc or on cassettes or whatever?
Well, I certainly can't speak for other companies at all, or for the idea that all companies would agree on anything of this earth-shattering in nature. I can't imagine they would. the business of controlling our own masters is by virtue of having our own engineers work on whatever reissue is being done, either for third parties like yourself or the Metropolitan Opera or even our own reissues, is quite understandable. We do not want to have this stuff go outside. Chances are there are people out there, other engineers, who will do as good as or a better job than our own, but I think exercise of control over one's own property is an understandable human quirk, if not a corporate quirk. I cannot really imagine that any corporation, and we're all getting sort of larger and larger, is ever going to be able to satisfy the individual needs of record mavens. And this is one of the comments I make again and again to the people who call up and or write letters complaining that we've deleted something, some wonderful record that should never have been deleted. And unfortunately, I have to remind them that we are commercial operations and that we are not in business just to satisfy maven collectors, that when we do issue something, we try to keep it alive as long as possible, but that there are commercial considerations which unfortunately do take precedence over a lot of others. And I don't think I've ever had a recording in the catalog for less than a couple of years, and I'm always happy to refer seekers to other countries where the performance might still be available if it's been deleted here. I don't think I can answer really what it is that you're trying to get at without much more specific examples, and again, I don't know if that really applies here. But no, I don't think a corporation will ever be able to satisfy individual mavens.
I find that when it gets to the minimal collections and the small collections and the archive collections, that you have to do your homework. The applications tend to come in the case of RCA, into the business affairs department. So right off, you're dealing with attorneys and accountants. I think if you may take the time and the effort to get to the archivist within the company, and if you're going to do this or want to do this obscure Eric Keevy collection, that the archivist can help to tell your story to the business affairs department, that this is for the XYZ nonprofit foundation, they only want to make 500 of them, and that, no, we're not going to charge you $20,000 for the 20 tracks. Mm-hmm. And we just had something come in this week where a nonprofit organization wanted a couple of obscure recordings, and the price was brought down to meet the needs of the nonprofit organization. So in the case of RCA records, I think you have to do your homework. And I'm also surprised that to date, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the ARS group, this huge group, has not gotten together and formed a collector's society, because I only speak for RCA now. If you did, and you wanted to release Eric Keevy or the organ recordings or whatever from our vault, we would definitely work with you, and we would see that you would do it right. That reminds me of two publications you should write away for. They're published by the Recording Industry Association of America, and they're at RIA. They're at 888 7th Avenue, New York, New York, 10106. There are two booklets. The first might be of interest to you. It's called A Statistical Overview of the Industry. The other booklet is a history of the industry and how the industry works today. What are artist contracts? What are mechanical licenses for works that come under the federal copyright law? The other one's a history.
A history of the industry.
History of the industry.
It's in the latest newsletter, and I will be correcting the mistakes in the books in the next
journal. OK, fine. I think we pay $100,000 a year to be members, but the books are interesting, and I do want to make the point: we're not staffed to deal with 5,000 archivists, but we would be staffed to deal with you as a group and to work with you in getting some of those collections out that you want to get out there. And I think there's a way of your doing it.
Well, I think that should be expanded. Here. I think that should be expanded because I think what we should do is go back to the... these are obviously have a limited market, and they are for archivists and for very serious collectors, these projects. And I think what Walter Legger started in the 30s was the way to go with private subscriptions. I mean, they couldn't have brought out the Landowska Scarlatti Sonatas or Gerhard Hirsch doing Schubert songs or the Mozart Opera Society or the Beethoven Sonatas was...